time. Assuming I don't run out of battery, which I might. It's low. All right. You've now read a bunch of stuff on Chinese law from somebody who knows much more about it, two people who know much more about it than I do. And I've got a list of things we can talk about, but let me start with you. What were the things that struck you or interested you and you'd like to raise or discuss about that very old legal system? Yeah? Yeah, I haven't figured out, as far as I can tell, I don't think that's actually true of the system at the time of the cases we're looking at. As far as I can tell, that was an argument made in the very early period by critics. And what is true later is that most of the population was illiterate, and it was in effect illegal to be a lawyer. That is, you get people prosecuted for the crime of helping other people with legal cases. And there's a case that some of you will be reading where basically the court decision says, well, he didn't actually defraud anybody, he didn't lie, he didn't distort it, but we're going to punish him anyway. So that might well have been that the attitude you seem to be getting is that if the people know too much about the law, they'll abuse it. They'll game the law, or they'll get into litigation they didn't have to get into, or something of that sort.
Is the criticism or the commentary I've read on the Chinese and the Australian law, so it's going before the change, that in fact it was very difficult for the people to know what was and was not legal. And so this attitude that is expressed in the introduction by Bode does in fact carry out all the way through Chinese society. It's not the case that it was not written down. If you were the Mandarin class, you could in fact know this stuff if you were expected to know it if you went out as a provincial official. But the average person did not know what the law was.
It sounded from this book as though the provincial authority also wasn't expected to know it. It was expected to have an employee who knew it. That at least according to this, the district magistrate was not trained in the law, he was trained in the classics, because that's how you got to be a magistrate, by passing the exam. But that one of his private employees, somebody he was paying, not somebody the government was paying, was a legal secretary.
It talks specifically about the government bureaucracy under the chain of the last dynasty.
Yep.
And it talks about the Yang officials, and they essentially would stay in place while the district people were rotated around.
According to this, you've got two different sets. You've got one set who are, in effect, government employees associated with the district, and another set who are private employees of the district magistrate who go with him. And you can see that, I think, if you look at the judge. Let me recommend, by the way, any of you who are looking for entertaining fiction right reading on this subject, the Judge D books by Van Gulik. I think in my chapter, I think I cite a book by Van Gulik, which is actually historical stuff. But he was a Dutch sinologist. And I think maybe like the Dutch ambassador to Japan or something like that. And he was a diplomat. And he at some point got upset over the fact that sort of young Japanese and Chinese adults were reading translations of junky Western detective stories. And didn't realize that there was a whole literature of Chinese detective stories, classic part of the Chinese literature. And he decided to do something about it. And he put together, the first book he puts together, he's taking essentially chunks of, I think, two of the classic ones and putting them together into one novel. And I think he published that both in Chinese and in English, though I don't swear that's right.
Chinese and English.
And he then later does a lot of things which are largely short stories to some extent. I think some of them are novels, which are, as he's describing, they're sort of a hybrid between the Chinese and the Western detective story tradition. Because in the Chinese detective story tradition, it isn't a puzzle for the reader to figure out. The reader sees the crime happening, typically. It's rather watching how the detective, sort of the reader, as it were, is looking over the shoulders of both the criminal and the detective and is watching the conflict between them as the detective tries to figure out what's happening. And Judge D is sort of the Sherlock Holmes figure. He was a district magistrate, not a private detective,
I guess, was a historical character, but was also the hero of a bunch of these stories. And so the Judge D stories are fiction with, as I say, somewhere between the Western and the Chinese tradition. They're good stories. I enjoyed them. But they also, I think, give you a pretty vivid picture of that society. And one of the things you see is that Dee has a few people who are sort of his followers, his team, as it were, and pretty clearly they're really his employees. And I think they go, and I think he's in more than one district in the course of the story.
I actually wrote the Wikipedia articles on those.
You did? Yes. Yeah. Well, they're good books. Donald Locke, who I think does the introduction, was somebody who I knew slightly. His daughter went to high school with me, and his wife, Alma Locke, actually wrote at least one cookbook. They were friends of my parents. He was a Chicago professor, so that was the connection, the historian. But anyway, but they were neat books.
Kulik ended up in Chung King, who was the ambassador from the Dutch to the Nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek.
Huh.
He married a Chinese woman, so he was living in China for 4 or 5 years during World War II. Had plenty of free time on his hands, given how powerful Netherlands was,
yeah.
i.e. zero, during the war.
Yeah.
And said, I got time on my hands, I can do something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he did various things. I think he's got a book somewhere which is on erotic art or something like that. I haven't read that one. Yeah. But that was a rare volume. But anyway, he's a neat guy. And they said the book, which I don't think I put on reserve, because I don't think I gave many readings in it, which I was reading, was one which is a collection. It's well considerably earlier than the period this is covering. It's a collection of famous cases which was supposed to be used for the education of district magistrate types. But it isn't really giving much legal detail. They're closer to how the wise officials saw through this trick or that trick and, you know, got the right.
I would say the fundamental point, though, about the Chinese legal system is that the government officials are supposed to judge on the basis of what they think is in the best interests of the society they are in charge of. And so while there may be a written law somewhere, they were free to disregard it.
That's certainly not.
They could be punished if it ended up that the court didn't like the way they approached things. But in general, the overriding goal is to create a harmonious society. And if you have to basically say, in this situation, I'm throwing away that standard law because circumstances suggest that that's the right thing to do, they can do it. They have enormous power.
Notice that you will be seeing in reading these cases, if you haven't started reading them yet, is not the court of first appearance, but rather the equivalent of the appeals court. And so we don't really, from these at least, you don't know what's happening at the magistrate level. But at least what these cases appear very clear, very explicitly to care about the law. That there are a few cases where it seems as though it isn't consistent with the law. But for the most part, it looks as though the main concern of the appeals court is figuring out, given the crime this person committed, what's the appropriate penalty. I mean, that's sort of what seems a little bit weird about it. As I think there's a comment in the parts you've read, that you have cases where they go into considerable detail on what's the appropriate verdict for somebody who's already dead. And another one where they say, well, the verdict that was given by the lower court is wrong. The right verdict is X. The two verdicts happen to have the same penalty. So in that case, it's a matter of getting it right, so to speak. And all of which seemed to me sort of intriguing and whole thing.
Injured party who, having suffered arson from a grudge-bearing scoundrel, then kills the scoundrel, but not immediately. In other words, not in the heat of passion. There is a law for that.
Yes. probably a sub statute.
Yes, the sub statute. It's like, right. You've got to be kidding.
As they go through it, you have the statutes which are narrow by our standards, but still not that narrow. And then it looks as though every time there was an interesting case which sort of didn't fit into everything and the court makes a decision anyway, that gets bumped up the lines of authority to the appropriate officials who decide whether or not it's sufficiently important. So you should add it to the law code and say, in this particular set of circumstances, here's what you do. In a way, it's an interesting contrast. I'm struck by in a sense, how much more individualistic the Islamic system is than the Chinese. Because the equivalent of that is the fatwa, but the fatwa has no legal authority at all. The fatwa is simply an opinion by a private legal expert, whereas the substatute is a court verdict that has been petrified into a new little detail of the legal code.
Well, the Chinese system is Athanasian system where the religion plays almost no legal, has almost no legal standing whatsoever. It's entirely driven by the rules as determined by the people who are running the system. And so we don't have countervailing force. In the European, we've got this balance between the church and state, and they're fighting with each other over lines of authority. In the Islamic world, it's the same thing. The Caliph essentially is not a religious leader, although he inserts some level of control. They've got these fatwas. Chinese state is completely on the side. There's no religion, but there's any authority whatsoever. It's entirely run by the state.
Doesn't Confucianism sort of play the role of religion in China?
People have. I've actually, I studied in a religious studies class in undergrad. It was the Mongolian period Han dynasty, how Taoism was taken. It's along the lines where you're saying where it's not a separate entity. It's not like a state versus church. Instead, Taoist ideas were simply up and borrowed by leaders. And it was especially, I guess there's this idea of goofy non-action. And if this, It has a lot to do with the idea that the harmonious nature occurring as it is has structure to it, and if you sit back and observe it, it will tend to solve itself. And I think that's what the idea behind their common law was. As far as, I mean, I don't know how much Taoism really plays into these later dynasties, but it seems to me that what they're doing is the way that they see special cases is like, oh, that's a distinct thing we had overlooked, and we're going to now try and scribe that down and say that's going to be a new rule or a substatute. That's them kind of taking this non-action approach to assembling a legal code, saying whatever nature decides to show us needs to be solved, we'll let it solve that.
But the odd thing is that if you actually look at what they're doing for most of the dynasties, it's a very far from laissez-faire approach. You might say, well, you know, the non-action, good, they're going to be good laissez-faire libertarians, let people, and there is this great quote from some point BC, which is sort of about, you know, you need farmers to have food and merchants have this and so forth. And once you have all of those, what need is there for bureaucrats and officials and such? But that was certainly not the dominant view of the Chinese state through history. And you get, you know, the ever-full granary, I guess it was called. You get a variety of sort of economic interventions. I think there's one dynasty which goes fairly far in the laissez-faire direction, but I forget which one it is. But
we're in the sense that their attitude was, we're going to govern the state. This is like 1350 to 1650. So we're fighting 300 million people, 150 million to 300 million people. And yet the total size of the bureaucracy is like 10,000. Yep. 10,000 bureaucrats was entirely running the entire state. And they were given essentially no pay, too. I mean, the bureaucratic pay was inconsequential in terms of, you know, what wealthy merchants could pay. And so the bureaucrats survived by taking massive bribes. But the idea behind the system was the guy who set this up hated the bureaucrats, didn't as the emperor, he didn't like them, didn't respect them, and he wanted to have as little, authority as possible over the state. So he kept them poor and he kept them in very small numbers and tried to, essentially the rest of the Chinese state runs almost on autopilot. It's an amazing system, but in practical terms, they wielded enormous power. They were essentially unconstrained by laws. They could do whatever they wanted. They took all these bribes, and no one could really say they weren't supposed to do them because they're really, you know, the laws and anyways. So it's a very, on the one hand, the political rhetoric was entirely along the lines of can't let the people do what they want, they'll get the government out of their hair. And the reality was, in fact, the government was extremely abusive.
Yeah, I think the dynasty I'm thinking of has got to be earlier, because if I remember correctly, it's the one that was ended by the Mongol conquest. Yeah, it sounds right. But anyway, so other comments by people, other things that struck you about it? Do you notice, by the way, this is really a comment not on China, but on the authors, the defensive tone of their writing? Right? They want to make the point that, well, this may sound like a brutal system, but compare it to 18th century England, compare it to the ways unpopular political views have gotten treated in modern times and so forth. And I thought it was sort of amusing, partly because I take the same attitude to my Icelanders, that, you know, you may think that the Icelandic saga period Iceland was a terrible society, but really, it was attractive in this way and attractive in that way, in the sense in which, you know, when you study a culture, you tend to get sympathetic with it. I suppose Mary Renault on ancient Greece might be an even more extreme case, but And I find it sort of amusing because, of course, they're not taking the same attitude to all the other cultures. So that they make a point of the fact that most of the people condemned to death in the Chinese system don't actually get executed. They presumably are unaware of the fact that in the 18th century English system, most of the people who are indicted for capital offenses don't get executed either, as far as we can tell. And we don't know which percentage is higher, but the one source I've got, which estimates results from a particular body of court they had data for.
You appear to have discovered universal truth with everyone looking at the legal systems, which they don't actually understand, inevitably perceive that as far more harsh than it really operates.
I have a similar theorem about slavery, that every system of slavery, as described to people who know the culture, is less ugly than slavery usually is. That every system of slavery, as described to people who really have studied the culture, is less ugly than everybody knows that slavery usually is. Now, I don't swear there are no exceptions, but I think there's a sense in which real-world slavery, because it's human beings and human beings interacting with human beings, there are a bunch of things modifying the formal set. Yeah.
Who would defend the slavery system in American
society? I don't know. You'd have to find somebody who was an expert in that. But I guess certainly people did at the time, right?
Some of spent enormous sums defending it at the time. So all that
Where you would, I don't know. That is, that sort of part of what forms our idea of what slavery is like. But I bet you could find a scholar who knew it, who could give you evidence of particular cases where the relationship was more human. It's not slavery, but take my anecdote with regard to Islamic marriage law about the woman who threatens to force her husband to divorce her. It's the same thing in the sense that sort of the black letter law, as it were, is women can't divorce their husbands can't divorce their. But when it gets down to human beings interacting with things, and I think it's one of the sagas where you've got a thrall who owns a famous sword, and his owner has to gain his permission to borrow the sword. Doesn't return it, but kills the thrall eventually. So there are certainly risks to this. But again, I was taking that as an example of slavery being less absolute than we usually assume.
Slavery in the South, in the American South,
is
a particular interest of mine, and I've never seen anyone
that's
ever
interesting. Well, it would be unpopular to do. I wonder if you're looking in the right places.
Yeah, sure.
No, I don't know about that case, but it's just my impression is that there are a bunch of these things where you have a sort of a simplified view of what something is like. And not that the U.S. has no truth to it, but that human beings engage in a lot of bargaining with it. For example, take the fact, you're aware of the fact that there was at least one steamship pilot who was a slave. I gather it was a not uncommon, though certainly very much minority pattern, that the slave owner, rather than having the slave working on the plantation, if the slave was skilled at something, allowed the slave to go to essentially run his own life in the city and just pay him essentially an income tax, as it were. And that there were a number of skilled people, and I remember noticing that one of those was actually a steamship pilot, which was a highly skilled, probably highly paid job, which really his master pocketed a large part of that pay.
Not to get a digression on this, but I think our evaluation of the slavery in the United States has got to provide, at least to some degree, at least that we're to take account the fact that Jefferson was quite clearly fathered by children with the slave half-sister of his first wife. And they all managed to move into society and create families and, you know, even live not far from the plantation.
But they were free. He freed them. But that's not an evaluation of slavery. That's an evaluation of how bad the racial situation is. But I've been struck from a number of different cases. The marriage, Islamic marriage, is another one of the sort of the general feeling and the status of women. You know, even in a society where women's status is formally very low, I suspect that there are able and competent women who manage to be important. People in that society, whether by manipulating men or by doing other things, depending on the particular case. So, Islamic society, for example, some of the legal scholars were women, which was a high status, important position, because Ibn Battuta lists sort of the people who he's learned stuff from. I remember the footnotes or something. It was clear that some of them were not, obviously, many fewer than men, but that there were some. But anyway,
So in the I was looking at, one of the things I was struck by is how willing the state is to punish people who, by our standards, are essentially guiltless because they are, in fact, either suffering attack and they are responding. So in the case of a guy who actually killed someone who had literally been extorting money for him for years and you know, had done all sorts of bad things, and the state acknowledged, yeah, this guy was a scoundrel that you killed, but you're not allowed to kill someone, and therefore the penalty for this was, you know, seven stinging blows from a heavy stick. No, that's not that one. It's, the penalty is 100 blows from a heavy stick, exile for 2,000 a year. So,
yep.
And this is, you know, in the United States, it's like, you know, he's a bad guy. What jury is going to convict you?
But, well, it's not clear. That is killing a blackmailer, or killing the man who's having an affair with your wife, which is one which comes up in some of these cases, is not legal in U.S. law either, and whether you get off or not is going to depend on the jury's sentiments, basically.
Right.
But there's one of them you probably didn't come across, which, if I remember correctly, the guy he kills either has just killed his father or is in the process of killing his father. They're attacked. He and his group have been attacked, and he still ends up, as I remember, punished for killing. It's a while since two years since I read the cases, so I don't remember details. Yet, I think there may be a self-defense available in some cases, but I think not in this, whatever
reason. This strikes me as odd.
Yep.
There seems to be rather more...
Well, there's another case which is in here, which is an interesting one, where you have an official who is being brought into, I think, a Confucian temple for a ceremony. I think it's Confucian. We do it. Temple for a ceremony in a chair, you know, one of these chairs with berries carried. And it's raining heavily, and I think it's dark. And he is supposed to stop at the entrance and do the appropriate, I don't know, his prostrations or something or other before he comes in. And he's in the chair, I assume with the curtains drawn, and his bearers, because it's pouring rain, take it straight through. And as soon as he realizes that, he gets out in a hurry. But he's violated the rules by coming through without doing the appropriate things, and he is, I don't remember, he's given a punishment, but he's also stripped of his position, which is a very serious punishment in this context. And it's pretty clear that, you know, the court realizes that in our terms it's not his fault, but, you know, that's what happened. And I guess the nearest case that occurs to me, well, I think we've mentioned before, is the case of statutory rape in our law, where even if the man had no reason to believe the woman was underage, even if the woman showed him a fake birth certificate, in principle, he's still guilty of a serious crime. Now, whether a jury would convict in that case, you don't know. And of course, in our tort law, there are lots of strict liability torts, which don't require any fault on your part at all, merely that you're the cause of something bad happening. Let me mention a number of things. I was sort of rereading the chapters yesterday and today. And one of the things, I thought it was interesting, sort of the initial discussion of Confucians versus legalists, that even though by the time you have a real legal system, you don't really have purely either, but as sort of different ways of thinking about the law and ways in which some of them both map and don't map into our intuition. So that, for example, the legalists at one end sound like law and econ types, right? They believe in incentives. They believe that if you want people not to commit crimes, you have to make it not in their interest to commit crimes. Sounds perfectly reasonable. But on the whole, in our legal culture, the law and econ types tend to be sort of pro-free market, not necessarily all of them, but as a general rule, whereas here the legalists are the totalitarians who want the state to control everything. So sort of as if you're starting from the same assumptions and going in the opposite direction. And one of the things I thought was sort of neat, because it's an issue which comes up, in the modern law and econ, is the argument that if only you make the punishment high enough, nobody commits the offense. As if nobody commits the offense, you never have to impose the punishment. So there's nothing wrong with having a high punishment. And it's not clear that it works, in part because you don't tax everybody with certainty, and maybe some people don't know that they'll be tortured to death if they commit illegal parking or whatever the thing is. And yet it's sort of, you think of it as a theoretical structure, it seems like a tempting kind of argument, and apparently it was also the
story on that one is the fall of the dynasty, is was provoked, and this is the legend that they were in 2,000 years.
This is the dynasty, the last 14 years or something.
The emperor's number of his dynasty collapses 2 years after his death, and it's provoked because one of the future leaders of the rebellion is leading a group of soldiers, and they have been assigned to a new fort, and they get to a river, and they can't cross the river because it's in flood. There will be no roads, no bridges, there's all the boats have been swept away, they can't cross the river. The penalty for failing to get to their fort on time is execution for the whole group. And so there they are, faced with certain death, that they actually go to the fort, and they say, better to rebel now and risk death than, you know, go there and be executed. And so that's the start of the revolt, which ends the dynasty. So having these incredibly harsh penalties, it's fine if there are no natural disasters. But
it was also fine if you have the unlimited force to impose them.
Yeah.
Right.
It doesn't work in practice. Yeah. Completely in practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, no, there's a sense in which that's a different problem which shows up in the law and econ literature, and that's the problem we referred to as marginal deterrence. That is to say, the way I usually put it is, suppose the highest penalty in your system is life imprisonment. And somebody says, armed robbery is a terrible crime, you should get life imprisonment for armed robbery. And the economist replies, do you really want armed robbers to routinely murder their victims? Because after all, the additional penalty for the murder is now zero. And if you kill your victim, he can't identify you in court. Now, that's a little too civil, because you can still try harder to catch people and thus raise the average penalty when they kill them. But as long as killing it does a sufficiently good job of reducing the chance of you getting caught, it becomes the idea works. So here, what they ought to have said was the penalty for not getting to the floor is you get executed, the penalty for rebellion is you get tortured to death, and so do all your relatives. And that might have been enough of a marginal deterrent so they wouldn't have rebelled. But it is...
It reaches a point where you
think it's very high.
The penalty
gets very high.
The legalists just adopted the extreme penalty for trivial offenses.
Yep.
That's the confusion.
Well, one of the weird things about the legalist thing, although it has a certain kind of logic, is that at least from the quotes here, they claim that not only does an official get penalized for not doing his job, he also gets penalized for doing his job too well. And the claim seems to be, if I understand correctly, that the official is in effect making an offer. The official is saying, here's what I'll do. Well, if he could have done all of that stuff, he should have made that offer, and then we could have made him do it. And the fact that he only offered to, you know, raise 1,000 men for his regiment when he could have raised 3,000 means that if he does raise 3,000, punish him. Right? If you read it, that was one of the things that struck me as very weird. But the claim, the quote at least from one of the legalists is saying that either over or underdoing what you claim to do ought to be punished. Going back to the Confucians, given this sort of picture of the legalists, we tend to think of the Confucians as the nice guys. But the Confucianists are the ones who violate what we take to be one of the axioms, namely everybody's equal before the law. All right, that's one of the arguments. The legalists, they're good moderns. They say, same law for rich and poor, high status, low status, mandarin and peasant, all the same law. Confucianists say, don't be crazy, that's wrong, people are different. And the Confucianists then vary it in two different ways. One of them is that officials have different laws than other people, sometimes harsher, often less harsh, but different. And the other is that quite aside from what your status is, the relation of people affects it. So that, for example, the penalty for attacking your district magistrate is higher than the penalty for attacking somebody else's district magistrate. Because I assume... I can't give a concrete answer to why, because I'm not one of the people who made these laws. But one speculation, one of the things, that's one of the questions I wanted to raise, but I think it's quite interesting, if you look at this system, is whether you have to explain its important features as due to the culture, or whether all or almost all of them can be explained as functional. That's sort of, I mean, that's an issue in law in general. When you say, here's a legal rule. Can we make sense of it as a sensible way of achieving an understandable objective? So that, as you may know, Judge Posner has this conjecture about the common law, that it's a set of rules which basically are designed to create an economically efficient and maximize the size of the pie, roughly speaking. Whether it's true or not is an interesting conjecture. It's given rise to a lot of interesting work. But he says it's just about the common law. But for any legal system, it's an interesting question to ask. Can we understand this as the rules a sensible person would have devised for some understandable purpose, or does that have a different explanation? And the Chinese, lots of it looks hard to explain in that way. But you can still try. And in this case, you could certainly say, but look, the threat to kill people who are ruling over you undermines their authority, whereas a threat to kill equally important people ruling over somebody else doesn't undermine their authority. And therefore, we want to do more to punish the one than the other. And similarly, I'm pretty sure that a slave gets penalized more severely for killing his own master than for killing another free man. I think that's right. Yep.
Is the other issue about the value that Confucianism places on certain relationships? So, husband and wife, the servant, the master, those are all
yes.
Highly placed relationships
yes.
in Confucianism. So, I would assume something similar with
yes, political power and no, ruler and subject is another one of the five relationships, and friend and friend.
It's probably safe too, because mobility is so poor in China. It's the odds of them actually worrying about somebody assaulting the governor of a different province.
Well, but the district magistrate and the district magistrate visit each other.
They do.
So he might be visiting.
Actually, they did. The people who wandered around were the censors, which I'm probably
yes. Right. So, yeah. The censors, I actually discussed that in one of the chapters, because the censors are the officials whose job it is to watch the other officials, whose job it is to get corrupt officials. And one of my chapters we haven't gotten to yet is the chapter on who guards the guardians, on how do you prevent whoever it is who is enforcing your legal system from themselves abusing their power. And at least in the Chinese case, they did have how, whether it worked, we don't know. I don't know, but they had the people whose specific job was that. But I guess my point is that you're offering what's in a sense the obvious explanation, and very possibly the correct one. I'm trying to see if you can avoid it. That is, the question I want to ask is, can we explain away, as it were, most of what seem to be features based on the culture? Now, it's a little tricky, because, of course, suppose you have a legal rule which would be a sensible legal rule if some factual proposition which is actually false were true, and the people in the culture believe it's true. All right. Well, is that a functional rule or a cultural rule? I'm not quite sure how you would fit it. So that one part of the explanation offered here for the rules is that they believed in this sort of an order of nature which man was a part of, and things that broke that order of nature had real world effects. So that if the emperor is too fond of women, there might be floods. That's the example happening in the book. But similarly, if I understand it, if somebody kills someone and the death is not requited by killing the person who did the killing, then somehow the balance of nature is out of whack, and that might have floods or have some other bad consequence. And if you think about the intuition behind that, I'm not sure that it's all that alien. That one of the things that I find, I've been arguing for a while, that the dominant religion in modern American culture is nature worship. And it doesn't call itself a religion. But if you think about the sense in which natural is in many contexts taken to automatically be a positive term, all right? That the fact that genetically engineered crops are unnatural in some context is treated as a reason to be suspicious of. And natural childbirth is a good thing, and natural foods, and sort of there's a whole bunch of stuff running through our culture, I think, which somehow imagines a natural order in which mankind is an intruder. Not the same as the Chinese. I think the Chinese mankind is more nearly a part of the natural order, but that a beaver dam is natural, Hoover Dam is unnatural. So I think there are sort of somewhat similar gut level responses that we have. And the show up in our culture. Yep. Oh, yep.
Do you think that intuition is new or unique to Americans?
No. But Americans don't. At least Americans of the sort I most interact with, which are academics and people online, said, don't believe they're religious, most of them. And it seems to me that you have a sort of like a stealth religion, as it were. There's Steve Landsberg is an economist I know, and he tells the story of he was, I think, in California, but I suspect not the Bay Area. And his daughter comes home and says that in class they're talking about Christianity in a way which takes it for granted that it's true. I'm not sure what they were doing. And Steve goes in to talk to the teacher. And the teacher is very apologetic. It just hadn't occurred to her that this wasn't ever believed in. And, you know, once it was pointed out, she realized that, you know, she wasn't entitled in a public school to be teaching Christianity. Then, some years later, in a different place, Steve's daughter comes in and tells him that they've been talking about the importance of serving Mother Earth. And Steve goes in and talks to the teacher about, you know, how come you're having this kind of religious stuff in... And the teacher was outraged. Anybody could possibly disagree with this. I mean, obviously, we are responsible for taking care of our Mother Earth. And I just sort of struck that. That's the difference between a religion that's sort of alive and self-confident and a religion that's sort of on its way out. Yeah.
You could say that about a lot of interests that you have. I mean, nature is one of them. The exercise is one. There's people that are fanatical about health, you know, or about... That's a religion.
Well, I think it's not the same thing. I mean, it's... I guess the distinction I try to make, and it's not a perfectly clear distinction, is between things that are about ends and things that are about means. That when you say something is sort of a value in itself, that in some sense that's a religious intuition. Now that includes a lot of things that probably most of us share, like, you know, people being happy is a value in itself. But that's different from the person who says, well, you ought to be careful what you eat because otherwise you'll get cancer. All right. The thinking that getting cancer is bad in some sense is a religious belief, it's just one we all share. But thinking that eating processed food will give you cancer is a factual belief, true or false. Somebody might be religious in the sense of obsessed about it, but that isn't quite the same thing. Now, the case that I may have mentioned before that I take for myself as evidence, as introspection, is the live oak tree in my backyard. Because I planted lots of fruit trees in my yard. A live oak tree is a waste of space from my standpoint because it doesn't produce any fruit. It's quite a large tree and it shades areas that I'd like to have more sunlight for my fruit tree. But I haven't taken it out. If lightning struck that tree and I had to remove it because it had been destroyed, I would be happy. My yard would be better. But it's a large living thing and it just feels wrong to me to hire someone to take saws and cut it down. All right? But that's a religious instinct, isn't it? Seems to me it really is. And I think, in a sense, almost all of these things, I mean, are legal. It helps if you can see them in yourself. I don't know if any of you have ever read any of the Father Brown stories. There's something else I recommend as good reading. G.K. Chesterton was this fascinating early 20th century English figure, intellectual, poet, novelist, essayist, eventually Catholic. He and George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells were friends who disagreed and would have public debates. They were sort of, in a sense, the three of them were seen as the same kind of status in the early 20th century, although Chesterton has become much less well-known later. And Chesterton eventually converts to Catholicism, and some of his essays are defenses of Catholic views, and the Father Brown stories are a bunch of early detective stories, very good detective stories. But they're also... Chesterton arguing for his views, not just about religion, about everything, so to speak. And that's quite the fun of him. He's a really good essayist. But there's one of them, The Confession of Father Brown. The first story involves this sort of master criminal, Flambeau, French, very sort of dramatic, talented criminal, who encounters Father Brown and Father Brown defeats, but is not arrested in the first story, but stops the crime that Flambeau was planning to commit. And Flambeau shows up later and eventually reforms. And there's a story which is set, I think, in Spain in Flambeau's house. And Father Brown is there as his guest. Flambeau, of course, is not under that name. He's going under an alias, but he's no longer a criminal. And there's an American tourist. Among all American tourists, he's basically a news reporter. This is Chesterton's view of all American tourists. And he's met Father Brown, famous man, wants to interview him. And so he asks, Father, how can you solve all these crimes? The answer is, well, it was really quite easy. I committed all of them. The guy sort of shocked. He said, well, it was a religious exercise suggested to me by Pope somebody or other that if you really want to understand a crime, what you have to do is to think yourself into being into imagining yourself as the person who would have committed that crime. And then you look around and you say, well, who is that person? Who is the person who fits what I've just discovered is, as it were, the mental state or psychology of the person who would have committed that particular crime. And he gives some examples from once where you know, it couldn't have been the obvious person because that isn't the crime that person would have committed and so forth. And the and he then but he then goes on to say, and of course this makes you much more sympathetic to the criminal, because you understand you could have been that person yourself, and you just have been. You've thought yourself into being him, and the American says, well, you know, isn't that going to make you soft on crime? And you know, it's all very well to talk like this here in Monsieur's so and so pleasant, safe house, but if there were a criminal in the room, and Flambeau stands up, and the firelight casts the shadow of his cloak against the wall, and he says, there is a criminal in the room. I am Flambeau, and the police of three continents are still looking for me. And I would still be a criminal if it were not for my friend Father Brown. And it's it was a wonderfully melodramatic scene. And I recommend the books anyway. But the point, the basic point, which I want to argue is as a more general point for academics, is that you want as best you can to think yourself into understanding and intuiting the views of the people you're studying. Because, you know, yes, there are a few small differences between 21st century Americans and 5th century BC Greeks or whatever, but they're all human beings. We're genetically very nearly the same as they are for all practical purposes, and the feelings they have probably fit somewhere in our head and our intuitions, and it's worth it for trying to teach them out. Anyway, long digression. Yes?
And
getting
back to China,
yes.
The interesting argument that the Confucians, or that you can make in favor of the Confucian theory on the inequality of humans, is that with one exception, the distinctions between the people are not based on their genetic inheritance or their family, but based on what position they have assumed within society. And to some degree, that position is voluntary. In other words, you can, in the later era, study and pass the test and become a member of the Mandarin class. And if you don't study and pass the test, your grandchildren will no longer be considered to be members of the Mandarin class. And the same is true for the people at the low end of the society, the people who cut hair and who are actors and theater troops, those people don't have to then adopt those jobs. They can actually move out of those professions.
Except that the people in the lowest standard above slavery are not allowed to take the test.
Well,
I think maybe their grandchildren or great-grandchildren can.
That was theoretically true, but in practice they actually didn't exclude them, because they didn't have to worry, because in fact you couldn't pass the test unless you had gone to the educational schools, and so they didn't need to worry about it. The reality was, even if you were from the lower background and officially you were excluded, they didn't actually worry about it, because if you weren't going to the elite schools, you couldn't hope to pass the test. So it didn't matter. They let you take them.
Except that if your parent was a member of that lower group and did well, you might be able to get the good training.
You might, yeah. But
and there's a case here, I think there are one or two cases of the ones we look at, of people who were discovered to be in that category and then fired, in effect. So, now I'm not sure whether it's somebody who ends up as an official. I think one of them ends up as a military officer. But at least they are people who had positions that were supposed to be closed to descendants of the, I don't know what the term is, but it's not quite slaves, but it's people in certain professions.
They have a term for it. It's like really disreputable, like untouchables in India. Oddly enough, barber is one of them, because you're not supposed to cut your hair. Why? Because it's part of your body which you owe to your parents. In the same way, getting a tattoo is completely forbidden. The same way it's a greater crime to have your head cut off as opposed to being strangled. You don't cut your hair. You don't own it.
That's
why barbers are this low class.
But I think one of the other categories, I think, were the employees of the magistrate. I think they were not allowed to, if I remember correctly. It seems a little odd. I don't swear that's right, but I think that's right. I think that's one of the things I came across here. But let me go back for a moment. I want to, because I think it's one of the more interesting things, this whole question of can you explain the system functionally or not. And I want to go back to the examination system, because that's one of the interesting puzzles. All right? Imagine a system where the way you get to be a judge is by getting straight A's in your English literature class and going on to do a PhD and write a highly cited thesis on Shakespeare. And that's how you get to be a judge. Very, very loosely, that's the Chinese system. All right, the Chinese examination system is that there's an exam open to most male Chinese, with some exceptions we've discussed, And the exam is in things like your ability to improvise poetry and how well you know the classics. It's basically how are you an elite of the sort of educated literary class. Nothing to do with knowing law, nothing to do with knowing science, none of that stuff. If you get a really good grade in that, you end up as a district magistrate or equivalent. You end up as an important government official. And the question is, why? Why do they have... Now, you could argue, even if we don't know why it's functional, it has to have been functional because the damn system lasted for 2,000 years. Right? That's a pretty, pretty good real
question. It's not that long. It's,
yeah.
The song put it in place. It's 1,000 years.
All right. 1,000 years. You're right. Yes. But the... Now, one person... I remember hearing a talk by somebody who claimed that the important change in it was when they went to blind grading. That initially it was not blind graded, and so it became, in effect, a hereditary elite, because if your father was an important official, the people who graded it knew that and would give you good grades. And that one of the, I think it may have been the same dynasty I was mentioning, Sung, is it?
Sung
turned into a blind grading.
They even recopied it, so we could not
yes,
tell who wrote
by the handwriting.
So
yep, that's right.
Crazy, enormous muscle work.
Yes. So, anybody want that? One argument is say, well, look, this is a culture that believes that literature is of great importance, and this is the soul of our people, as it were, and so forth. And that's what a cultured gentleman does. Can somebody offer an alternative explanation? Is there an explanation in which, if you were a sort of objective, cold-minded social designer, social planner, you would say, yeah, that's what we're going to do? Anybody want to? I think it's an interesting challenge. Yes?
It has some of the benefits of the amateur legal system that jury provides. And for all of its faults, the jury system that here and previous British implementations has been well respected and has worked relatively well and has maintained its consistent presence. And I think that has to do with the fact that people recognize here in China, these questions are very difficult to answer. Who's in right, who's in wrong, what's the damage that's done? And so amateur there at least have the benefit of saying, well, that's an answer.
Note that, in a sense, it just occurred to me, this is our third iteration of the division between legal expertise and real-world expertise. Only it's odd kind of real-world expertise. But that the American court system, the in principle, it's the appeals court that really has to know the law. And the court of first impression, though, of course, we expect it to know the law as well, in a sense, is an expert at figuring out who done it, so to speak, with the jury and the judge both involved. And in the Islamic case, you've got the Mufti-Qadi distinction. And in this one, you've got the distinction between the legal secretary employee of the magistrate, who's the one who's supposed to know the law and tell him about it, and the appeal system as well, and the magistrate himself. But then the puzzle is why they aren't picking the magistrates at random the way we more or less pick jurors. Why does being an expert in Chinese literature provide the basis for being a wise and just...
Well, we can't have implied qualifications for jurors. I mean, and I'm not talking about just people who are in San Juan. Just about every attorney wants to have one of the more malleable middle section. You don't want engineers. You don't want housewives in certain cases. We do have kind of unwritten qualifications for what makes an ideal juror for a particular background. But
that's very modern, isn't it?
Right, right. But I think it's the same. It's the same idea. Is that you want some qualifications. You don't want it to be random. And if our society respects an average juror, their society might have respected a culture.
Notice also that the magistrate isn't only a judge. He's also the mayor and the chief of police. That is, he's running where the rubber meets the road. He's the guy who's running the system.
There's an interesting historical sidelight to this, which is early on in the Song, there were multiple types of exams you could take, and some of the exams were highly technical and focused on people with skill in mathematics and the exams were focused on actual knowledge of historical events, so you could pass at the history level, the math level, or the generalized sort of poetry level. But for reasons that are not clear to me, or to the historians I've read, over time, the guys who graduated from the general poetry exam gained more status as a result than the guys who graduated from the more technical exam things. And so it became the way to the upper echelons of the government faster to have graduated from that exam than the poetry exam, as opposed to the other guys. And over several hundred years, people just stopped taking the other exams, and they just went for the poetry exam. And they would, essentially, it over time, over several hundred years, essentially, the other more technical exams, the ones that make sense for government officials, dropped away, and we're left with just, oh, well, you're a master of poetry, we're going to give you the top award, and now you go into government.
Notice that there's a sense in which we've imitated the Chinese. If you think of the liberal arts degree, there's a certain sense in which in our culture, at least for the last century or maybe a little over, there's been this idea that what is a college education? Well, maybe you're going to learn some actually useful things like engineering, but the guts of the college education is Shakespeare and poetry and history, even though most of the people who are getting the education are going to do a job to which those things don't seem very relevant. So whether we were wrong or they were right, there really is a noticeable element of the Chinese approach in our culture. Yep.
It would also be very helpful to know how they act because poetry is if they're reading, ancient Chinese versions of Aesop, and they're supposed to be learning lessons that are foundational, that are teaching them things about how societies are supposed to interact with each other.
Or how people work, or that's one possibility.
Here's an example. One of the things you were supposed to be able to do in the exam is you were supposed to be able to tell the examiner how many times a particular character appeared in the Confucian annals. So they would say, here's a character, how often does this particular character appear in the sayings of Confucius? In order to answer that question, you have to memorize it all and have a count in your head. How many times does the word gen come up? Or how many times does the word brotherhood come up? I mean, an insane level of memorization is required.
That's a question asking for a piece of trivial knowledge, but to have that knowledge, you obviously have to be well-versed in the foundational material.
And if you believe that the sayings of Confucius really are wise, then in memorizing them, you might have learned something. See, another possibility that occurs to me is this is an IQ test.
It is.
And, there is the argument, which some people agree with, some debate, that in our society, IQ predicts quite a lot of outcomes. Not perfectly, but statistically with quite a lot of significance. And so maybe what's going on is that what they really wanted was not people who knew anything. They wanted smart people. And one test of a smart person is they tell you you've got to know this to pass the test. Can you learn it? And it's not only a test of a smart person, it's a hardworking person, a person who's willing to, to memorize the Analects of Confucius, if that's what it takes to get a job as a man.
The poetry that was written was constructed such that you actually had to, really master of Chinese poetry. Not only is it constructing things that make sense when you read it literally, but they make sense at different levels, so that individual characters are composed of elements. And then you look at those individual elements in comparison to things directly below them, and so you can see how that echoes things going on elsewhere. And you also have to include historical allusions, so you're actually referencing things that are related to previous events that occurred in Chinese history in your little poem. So your little poem is only like 64 characters, and yet it compresses so much information. The masterpieces of these are so incredibly dense in terms of information that only an expert can understand what you've done. Done it right. So mastery of this poetry is absolutely intelligent.
So anyway, I don't know what the right answer to any of these questions are, but it seems to me it's an intriguing question. And there are going to be a bunch of other, I thought that the exams were the clearest example of that puzzle. But if you look at other things like the fact that they could only execute people on certain days, well, that's hard to believe that's functional, but it also isn't very expensive. Right, all that means you got to hold them a little while longer until you get to a day where you're allowed to chop the guy's head off or whatever. Yeah.
That's another Taoist notion, where Taoism is really obsessed with certain meditations are only allowed to be done at certain times of the day or certain times of the year or certain times of in the way they break up their seasons. You can only do it in the early part of the season. They're very obsessed with that.
That's basically, it sounds from this as though the pattern exists before the Taoists become influential, but then expands to cover a lot more days under Taoist influence and then declines later. But again, in a sense, I'm not much bothered if cultural factors change things that don't matter. The puzzle is if cultural factors explain how they chose their bureaucrats in a way that didn't make any sense, and that would be disturbing if true. And I'm not sure, because on the one hand, sort of I give both sides the argument. Yeah.
Stepping back to the question about why would you want to have your judges being masters of literature?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to note that there was a very strong similar movement in the American legal and medical institution not 10, 15 years ago, where you have lawyers and doctors being forced to read like Shakespeare and American Lit on the notion that it instilled some like humanitarian ideals or like compassion or some other thing that a legal education didn't give you or a medical education didn't give you.
Yeah. Yes. Well, but that's in a sense related to my point about liberal arts education. This sort of, you know, why is it that the default college degree is a Bachelor of Arts? And yet that's a characteristic of... I don't want to argue whether it's right or wrong. I just observe that we have the same attitude, and you can make arguments for it and arguments against it.
I think it's interesting that in the American system, we've particularly targeted professional schools by infusing them with literature.
But I don't think it's particularly in the sense that I don't think business schools do that as much, but if you think about the fact that to get to all these professional schools, almost everybody has to get a 4-year college education. And in that, depending on the school, there's at least a strong tendency. Conservatives complain that it's less true than it used to be. I'm not sure if it is, that you have a compulsory core of common education stuff. But it's still quite a lot of it is true, and I'm not saying if it's less or not. But there is sort of this assumption that everybody is supposed to be an educated person. You're supposed to have studied a foreign language. You're supposed to have studied history. You're supposed to have studied literature. And those are interesting things. The world is full of interesting things, but it's not clear to me how many of the jobs that people are going to college with the expectation of getting, or how many of the lives they're expecting to live. I mean, it would make sense if you say yes, and then all the college graduates, instead of watching television, read great novels. But I bet a very small fraction of them actually do. I mean, yeah.
I agree that to medical school, for example, unlike the Chinese system, we do require that you got a medical degree
as well. Yeah.
But I think I could find objective data where medical schools that require the graduates to take courses in literature.
Yes, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. Yeah. But as I say, they in a sense require all of them to do it because they have to get an undergraduate degree first.
Right? Yeah, sure.
In terms of two sides of the argument, whether it's cultural, on the one hand, you've got this idea that the balance of nature requires a life for a life in some circumstances. But then you observe that they cheat on it, right? That is to say, yeah, you're going to be killed. When are you going to be killed? After the assizes. Well, that means you probably aren't going to be killed. Maybe you'll be killed, but the odds are you aren't. So it's unclear to me whether what's really going on is that the legal system is being constrained by cultural things that have little to do with function, or whether what's really going on is that the cultural things you have to pay nominal obeisance to, but any time they actually get in the way of the way you want to achieve your objective, you find ways around them. Yeah. But you can ask whether features of the law are consistent with the idea that the law is designed to achieve some plausible objective. It doesn't have to be posed to sufficiency. The objective could be maintaining the power of the state or the emperor. That's a perfectly comprehensible objective for a legal system set up by the emperor. But between that and saying the only reason they do it is... So one of the other ones which struck me, which seemed to be sort of hard to explain, is this business of the fact that the magistrate, as well as everybody else, has to mourn for 27 months. I don't know why it's 3 9-month years instead of 3 real years, but for 27 months if his father or mother dies. And apparently that means he's got to go on retirement for that period of time. You've got this limited number of bureaucrats, and here you've got a guy who's functioning just fine running his district. Oops, his father died. Sorry, buddy. See you in 2.5 years.
God forbid, if your mother and then father die in 3 years apart, you're out of action for six whole years.
And not only are you out of action, but it sounds as though until one of the later dynasties, if your wife gets pregnant during this period, you're in real trouble, because one of the things you're supposed to do during mourning is abstain from sex.
It's not entirely clear that that's absolutely true.
Well, at least according to this, that gets repealed by one of the later, I think it may have been the last dynasty or the next to the last dynasty, that the emperor basically says that's contrary to human nature, scrap it. But that was the rule, yep.
It's just simply like, when I took the law and philosophy class in undergraduate, we learned a lot about legal realism, which posits that what the law is, the relationship between what the law is and what's actually written on a page is not...
What to what?
Yeah, right. That what's written on the page only bears some relationship to what the law is.
Yes. And that may well be true here as well. Yep.
Right.
Yep. That is, what sounds, one of the impressions you get reading this is that there may be an important division between the parts of the law that are enforced by bambooing and the rest of it. Because the bambooing stuff can be handled by the district magistrate, and he's got to give aggregate reports going up the ladder, but he doesn't actually have to send the case to any superior and have it approved. So it might be that the district magistrate, as long as the punishments he's giving are only beating somebody, has a whole lot of flexibility to do what he pleases. But for anything higher than that, when he's going to be executed or sent some distance away in exile, in internal exile, then all of that is supposed to be done according to a formal legal code, which is what we're getting reflected in these cases. And you know, now I don't know. Where you would get a good source for the lowest level. One of the things that one of my students did 1 year, I think at my suggestion, was reading a novel. A novel written in ancient China, the novel in question being Golden Lotus, which is famous both as literature and as pornography. When I first encountered it in the library of Harvard when I was an undergraduate, the pornographic passages were in Latin, and the rest was in English in the translation. Obviously, scholars knew Latin. Trust not to be corrupted by this stuff. But it's largely about corruption. That is to say, the central figure is a rich merchant who gets away with doing quite a lot of different, obviously illegal things by some combination of cleverness and bribery and such. And so reading that gave you at least a primary source contemporary picture of how the system really worked at ground level, which was a good deal less attractive than the sort of theoretical structure. And that would be interesting. I mean, you'd like more than one novel, but to see if you could figure out, in a sense, to contrast the legal system as you see it in these 190 cases with the legal system as you see it in contemporary portrayals of how that system was working. I should say the story, by the way, of how Golden... You have to realize that Golden Lotus was a bit of a problem from the Chinese standpoint. Because how could great literature be written by somebody so corrupt as to print pornography? And the answer was very simple. There was a virtuous official and a corrupt official. And the corrupt official somehow by intrigue gets the virtuous official destroyed or killed or something. And the corrupt official has a son who is an even worse corrupt official. Ah, but the virtuous official has a son who is not only a virtuous official, but a paragon of the literary arts. And is dedicated to revenging his father. So what does he do? He writes this book, and he writes it in such a way that he knows that if he gives the copy to the corrupt, second-generation corrupt official, he will be unable not to read it straight through. Right? That's why it's pornographic. And he makes a copy of the book, and in the corner of every page, he embeds a grain of poison. And he then gives it as a present to the corrupt official. And the corrupt official reads the book. And drops dead on the last page. And supposedly one of the characters in the book is a portrait of the corrupt official. Story. And of course, so that explains why it's great literature. It was written by this wonderful person, and it also explains this other features. And I like that story. It's not a bad book either.
I have a father was like 16 years old, so he's still young. He needs the advice of senior counsel. And this guy has been the chief minister for several, like 10 years or something, and is loved by the emperor. And his one of his two parents dies, and according to the rules, he literally has to go into mourning for 3 years. The emperor begs him to not go into mourning just yet, until we can select somebody appropriate to take over for him. It may take several months, and the guy agrees. He is then attacked vigorously for the remainder of his life, which is like 2 or 3 years, for failing to ignore the emperor and go into mourning immediately as he was supposed to. And that's an attack against him by other members of the imperial bureaucracy. Okay. It's like, you fail to follow the rules and you listen to what the emperor said.
Yeah, interesting. The other thing is comments?
I just wanted to point out the 3 years of 9 months.
Yes.
That anything that's an iteration of three or multiple of three is probably coming from the I Ching, which is a pretty Taoist text that came from the Mecca Turtle or something. But it's that the series of broken or straight lines that go in a circle.
Yep.
That's probably the relying on that to go with the numbers.
Any question about papers? When should we have them to you, or when should we be prepared to present? So I realize that in what, a week, after 2 weeks, It says student papers.
Yes, I haven't been looking at the syllabus. I should have been.
Yeah,
that is it. But that's supposed to be a draft. That's okay. Right. That's the point at which you want a draft which we could discuss. I think I've got the syllabus set up, so we've got some blank space at the end that we are supposed to be using for discussing the papers. So. At whatever it says in the syllabus, you were supposed to have some draft sufficiently advanced so that I can stick it up on the web, the other students can read it, and we can talk about it for 15 or 20 minutes.
I believe it's the first week in April.
I'll take it. Very good. So, at that point, obviously it's not going to be the final version because part of the point of the discussion is to learn more stuff and so forth, but it's supposed to be enough of a version so that we can have an interesting conversation about it.
Will you assign presentation dates?
Yeah, as once I get them, I will probably say which of these look most interesting to me. Let's start with those. And
so should we all be prepared to present that first on the second?
Yeah, I guess you should be. Although presumably, once I start getting them in, I can start putting them up on the syllabus when I know. But anyway, if you've got a draft, you should be ready to present, right? Spending lots of time making sense of this thing and presenting really is, as they email them to me so I can web them, and then everybody else can read them, and we can go on from there. That's at least the theory of what we're doing. Let's see, other things. The going back to this, to the inequalities of the law. Functionally, I think they make lots of sense. That is to say, it makes sense that you're more worried about people attacking the important people above them than important people who aren't above them. It makes sense that the relation between husband and wife is different than between them and other people. And it makes sense that the relation between husband and wife is not identical to wife and husband. They really are functionally different. And at the same time, if you look at the actual legal cases, there's clearly a lot of discretion. That is to say, there are various cases in which your status gives you the possibility of a commutation, which is really very close to a pardon. If you look at these things, that you've got some very serious sentence, and the commutation is for a trivial money payment, for less than an ounce of silver, is an example they give. So, in one sense, the part of this sort of reflects possibilities, but it also reflects giving control to the authorities to decide when they should or shouldn't work on them. And one of them, which I argue in my chapter is sort of one of the interesting features of all of this, is the differing rules within the family, which I see as a mechanism for maintaining the internal authority of the extended family as a way of getting somebody other than the legal system to control people. And I think that's as I read at least part of what's going on. The other things worth looking at. The business of retaining the form but changing the substance exists not only with postponing executions, but also with the fact that the number of blows isn't really the number of blows the law says. It's that transmuted through a formula which gets you down to about 40%, if I remember correctly, of the number of blows the law says. The book offers a conjecture as to the reason for that. The other features going back for a moment to the legalist versus Confucian, again, what's sort of neat is that the legalists look pretty ugly, and yet they seem to be on our side in a bunch of things. That they believe in rule of law, not men. Same law for everybody. They believe everybody's equal before the law. And yet, they last 14 years or whatever. And they also believe in burning books that argue for things they don't agree with. So that they are sort of this weird hybrid of values that we see as inconsistent with each other.
Actually, that apparently is not true. That was believed, but the current historical research
is
that
it didn't happen.
What happened was that the bunch of books were collected in an imperial library, and then when the revolution broke out, which ended the first dynasty, that library was destroyed. And so bunches of books that had been collected there ended up being destroyed, but it wasn't a policy.
That's
the book I've read just recently. But yeah, 1960s it was believed, and for many years before it was believed that was what happened, but it's not no longer.
This is reminding me of the Library of Alexandria, which there are, I think, at least three different people who are responsible for destroying the Library of Alexandria over periods, centuries apart, because it makes a good story, basically. There seems to be very little out. It is clear that there was once a great library in Alexandria, and it is clear that over some period of time it gets more or less destroyed. But it is pretty clear that the Caliph Umar did not say everything in it either is in the Quran and therefore is superfluous, or isn't in the Quran and therefore is wrong, so use it to heat the baths. That's one of the standard stories. And I think it is conceivable that when Julius Caesar attacks Egypt, that there might have been a fire started accidentally in the course of that, and I forget what the third explanation is, but there are at least
riots in it's the movie, the reason
right, that that's know, right,
the riots about Christianity
right,
sense.
Yes, so anyway, it's but that's another one where it makes a good story and therefore of course it survived. Alright, well I think we're about out of time, and you have some more reading to do, I think, for Tuesday, which ought to be fun, I hope. Thank you.